Nice guess, asshole. I'm a cop. That was a bad guy.
Where's your ID?
On his way to Cleveland?
Hello there, and welcome to Out of Theaters, the podcast that reviews the movies of yesteryear, this year. My name is Billy Culpa, and I'm here with my good friend and film critic, Will Pfeiffer. Will, hello.
Billy, how you doing?
Well, we're trying a different method of recording today. We're trying this over the phone, so we'll see how this goes.
Because we're not facing each other now. We can't pick up on each other's visual cues.
We had sad news this morning. You want to talk about that?
We did, yeah. It was quite shocking, actually. Carrie Fisher, who had a heart attack a couple of days ago, but was reported to be doing well and in stable condition, she died today at the age of 60. And though she's, Carrie Fisher has done a lot of things in her life, but I think we can all agree that she is most famous for and will be remembered as playing Princess Leia in the Star Wars films, of course.
I read this great little, because, there's a million in memoriam pieces out today.
Of course.
I read a great one today about how she used how much she hated her metal bikini as her inspiration for murdering Jabba the Hutt.
There you go. I think that's great, yeah.
She killed him because of that, which, I think it's apt. It works for her.
I mean, I was 16 when Jedi came out and she was in the metal bikini. Let's face it, there are few people on this planet more wanting to see female flesh than a 16-year-old boy. But even I thought that it was a little, much. It seemed like a little bit of a stretch. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Her quote, she says, quote, "The father who flipped out about the bikini, what am I going to tell my kid? Why is she in that outfit?" She says, "Tell him that a giant slug captured me and forced me to wear that stupid outfit, and I killed him because I didn't like it. And then
there
I went back on stage and I took it off."
There you go, Princess Leia. Okay, well, I will say this. Besides being an actress and Hollywood royalty, she was the daughter of Debbie Reynolds, of course. She was also an acclaimed author. She worked on movie scripts. It's come out in the last couple of days. I've seen a few people post this scan of I believe it was an Empire Strikes Back script that she has sort of doctored and monkeyed with her lines with, to make it a little... a little bit. She just liked the scene. She came up with the line, when they're drifting off from the Star Destroyer, with the rest of the garbage, and all those kind of little nice moments. She tweaked a lot of her own dialogue in that. Well, so she was, she was not just the princess. She did a lot of other things too. Coincidentally, right, even as we record, I'm in my basement right now, my daughter, 10-year-old daughter or 11-year-old daughter is upstairs watching the original Star Wars, A New Hope, but, and I was kind of doing some stuff and half watching it, and, Princess Leia, especially in the first half of the movie, she's not on screen much, but her character comes through. I mean, a lot of we're going to talk a little bit later about Rogue One, where some of the characters, they just didn't seem to make an impact, but Princess Leia, right off the bat, she gives R2 the information, but then she's standing up to Vader, she's back-sassing Tarkin. I mean, there's something there. She never was just the damsel in distress.
No, she's on equal ground to Vader. It's weird, too, because Vader comes off, he's so scary, right? The opening scenes are just him murdering people. And
right.
Then he sees, 5'2" Carrie Fisher or whatever height she is. And
tiny.
Right away she says, "Hey, man, jerk, get out of my way." She walks right up to him and it's just like punches him in the mouth.
Yeah.
What's
tough.
The line
she
says? She says, Tarkin let his dog out or something like that.
Yeah, it says she leaves or something. And then she tells Tarkin, the foul stench. I mean, her accent, we've mentioned before in this podcast, her accent flips back and forth between American and British. But, it's all kind of fun. When I was a kid, she was the girl in Star Wars. But, damn it, she was a cool girl in Star Wars. So.
Yeah, for sure. And then for me, too, So, which kind of contrasts nicely with Rogue One, which you just saw, what, this morning, last night?
I just saw it like 12 hours before news came across that Princess Leia's dying about. Yeah. So, Rogue One.
You talk about that a little bit. What'd you think? I mean,
okay,
we should say, too, we should try to do this without spoilers. I mean, it's hard, right?
It's hard. But there's one thing I definitely am going to spoil, just given the news of today. So, there's going to be some spoilers, I think. In fact,
maybe skip ahead about
spoilers.
10 minutes, guys. We're going to spoil a little bit.
Skip ahead about 10 minutes. And if you're listening to this podcast, I'm guessing you probably saw Rogue One or you're planning to. But anyway.
I made $500 million already.
Yeah, exactly. I liked it. I think, I mean, you know, it's hard to tell almost. You come out of the end, you're still kind of buzzing. But I would say I liked it better than A Force Awakens. However, like I alluded to a little bit earlier, I think the characters I really didn't grab onto any of the new characters in this movie.
I think that's fair. I think I agree with that. I actually think I like Force Awakens a little better. It's more fun and feels more Star Wars. This felt like Star Wars adjacent. But I completely agree. The guy who I thought was French, but turned out to be Mexican, Casillas?
I think. I also can't remember the names of these characters.
That is a problem. I couldn't either. Jyn Erso, right?
Yeah, Jyn Erso, I believe, yes. And Bodhi was the defector from the Empire.
The pilot who looked like he had a little bit too much meth.
I just always called him the guy from the night before because he was in the night before. Plus, he was in Nightcrawler.
That's actually, Will, that was my point. You called him the guy from the night before. I called the dude who I thought was French, who was Mexican, but he's from the Terminal. He was the little garbage maintenance guy in the Tom Hanks movie Terminal, where he proposes to, who eventually
becomes... Oh, really?
He proposes, like, in a Star Trek fashion.
I've seen the Terminal.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. It's a run-of-the-mill. It's a good Tom Hanks movie. Whatever.
It does have America's Greatest Actor in it, but...
America's Greatest Ass. But the point is, I couldn't remember. I still don't know his name. I think it's Casillas, but I can't remember. It makes it tough when you watched the movie 12 hours ago, and we are unsure of the characters' names.
I was unsure of the characters' names coming out. Although, I'll tell you whose names I did know. I knew Grand Moff Tarkin, and I knew Darth Vader.
And Princess Leia there, too.
Princess Leia, that's what I was going to... The one spoiler, so if you haven't seen it, here's your last chance to ditch, but the movie, like we all know, it's about the rebel spies who stole the plans for the Death Star, and in the very last frame of the movie, the plans are handed off to Princess Leia, and it's a digitally, I don't know if it was an actress with her face digitized on,
but anyway, it's
young Carrie Fisher, yeah.
Yeah,
and
they used actors for both her and Grand Moff Tarkin.
And Grand Moff Tarkin gets a lot more screen time, though. I was surprised how much he got, considering he's been dead for 10 years, 15 years.
You know, it's really... So when I watched it, I thought his face was a little weird, but it was acceptable. But I had a harder time with his... He was twitchy. His body motions were sort of weird. And I thought, it must be hard to program a body like that. That must be difficult. But what I found out later was they actually just had an actor on stage. And that was an actor trying to, like, emulate... The guy who played Tarkin?
Peter Cushing.
Cushing, yeah. They that was an actor trying to emulate Cushing, and he overdid it so much. It was very, very jarring to me. I don't know how you felt about Tarkin, but...
I thought it was okay. It wasn't perfect, but I kind of went with it. Princess Leia, though, I was a little... I mean, she was only in screen for like a second, and I think they knew they couldn't hold it very long. But it's close, but they're just not there yet. You know, it's that uncanny valley. They're just not quite there.
I like that in a universe where we have space pilots and, you know, flying slug monsters and just whatever, you know, whatever crap you can think of. We're super upset that Peter Cushing was fake and that Carrie Fisher was fake.
I know. And the other thing I kept thinking of is in a world where there's faster than light travel and laser weapons and planet destroying satellites, they really haven't, Billy, this must give you nightmares. They really haven't gotten past hard copy storage of data, have they?
I thought that was so weird. I was like, really? It's the future. We need to get a disc. And it's literally, she said, they call it a tape. I'm sorry.
Right. When they were uploading I felt like I'm back in the 1990s when every movie, the most suspenseful place was watching that little bar move across the screen. Sorry.
Here's why I appreciate it, actually. I like that they realized they're stuck with 1970s technology, and so they just went with it.
I agree.
Everything in A New Hope is on tapes, and she injects a little cassette or whatever, so whatever she jams mm-hmm. into R2-D2, you know, they just stuck with it. It's fine with me. I thought it was a grown-up, maybe to back up a little bit, Rogue One was a lot more grown-up than I expected.
It was dark.
Big spoilers. Everybody dies.
Every single character that you meet in this movie, like that you didn't know before, dies. Yeah, every single one.
They're part of the Rebel Executive. The Rebel Executive team, right. They're fine.
Yeah, Gold Leader, Red Leader, they're good.
Yeah, and Mon Mart, what's her name? I feel terrible. Mon Mothma. Yeah, Mon Mothma. I'm not peep-nerd, like, but there are many other people who know way more about Star Wars than me, but when you meet the average person, I know a lot more than them, and I still never know the character's name.
Mon Mothma, yeah, she survived. And Vader, of course. Here's what I like. I love, maybe even more, so I think I liked it better when everyone was dead in, like, that last 2 minutes of the movie, because what happens is they upload the plans, and then they're on a ship, and I loved how...
A big fleet-leading rebel ship.
Right, and I loved how they're like, okay, get everyone out of here. And earlier, Grand Moff Tarkin said, Vader will take care of that fleet. And normally you're like, oh, but they're going to get away. But they didn't really get away because they're all set to jump to light speed, and then that Star Destroyer is just there, you know? And they're crashing into it. I thought that was pretty good. And then when they're trying to hand off these anonymous rebels who you don't know who they are, they're like the guys you see at the very beginning of Star Wars. They're trying to desperately hand off this disc, and Vader comes in and just slaughters them. And it's intense. It's good.
It might be Vader's best 2 minutes ever.
It seriously might be, because it's like, now you know why at the beginning of the original movie, everyone is scared of Vader, because he is a monster, really.
He is a murderer. You know, there's one scene in A New Hope where he's, like, trying to get through the door, and he, like, stumbles, and he's kind of, like, trying to crawl over dead, you know, rebel troops and dead storms. And it's just embarrassing. It's just a tall, awkward guy not trying to get... He can't get through it. He's, like, trying to get out of a Volkswagen, you know? It's, like,
a
flattering way to make him. But in this, he's just cool. I mean, he's fast.
I mean, they
fire
him, and he just, you know, reflects all the bolts back and slamming him around with the force and just killing him. And I love that these guys, I mean, I thought it was kind of cool. These are like the unnamed heroic rebels, but they are, you know, that one guy hands it off just in time, and then you know where the whole movie's going.
I have a few other small notes for you.
Uh-huh.
James Earl Jones is sounding old.
Well, he is not a young man.
It's evident. It was pretty clear to me when watching this movie that James Earl Jones is 85 or whatever the hell he is.
Let's see, he was born in 31. Yeah, he's 85. He was younger than I am when he was originally Vader. He was, you know, like 45.
So he's led your entire life since this first thing came out.
Pretty much.
I could tell. His costume looked bizarre. I thought Vader's costume looked like a costume Vader.
Yeah. Because it was, they wanted to mimic the look of A New Hope, right? Or
I guess, right? I mean, isn't that kind of what had to happen? It's funny,
too. Although, frankly, I don't know if people would have noticed, but...
Why Star Wars is impossible, and why, no matter what, they can't succeed, because we're both perfectly cool with them mimicking the tape effect in a world where they could just email the file attachment or whatever. We're like, they have to get a tape, and we're like, yeah, of course they do, but at the same time, the director, following the same logic, says, well, the costume needs to match, and we're like, it looks bad.
I know. You're never going to please us. And you know, here's one thing I'm thinking. It's like, I mean, I love the fact they're making Star Wars movies now, but at this point, they're just movies. It's like every year there's a Marvel movie out, and it's like, well, that's nice.
Yeah,
but nothing's going to be The New Hope or Empire Strikes Back. Even if it was better, it could never be that, like, for me, personally.
You said this a few weeks ago, you know, that this might be the new... On the last Star Wars episode we did, you said... you know, you thought when Force Awakens came out that this would be Allie's Star Wars, and then
Right.
And then you realize, well, nope, it doesn't. She already has this. She has Harry Potter. She has Hunger Games. She has a million other things. And I think you're right. I think it was very accurate.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, they're fine movies, but they're not, you know, they're not they're not the bomb that was dropped in 1977 when Star Wars came out, you know, changed everything. And they can't be, which is fine.
Sure.
Let me make one more two little things for me. One, I know they had to put 3PO and R2 in, okay?
Yeah.
But why didn't they just have them on the ship at the end? They could have had somebody just walk past them in the hallway. You know? They didn't have to be at the Rebel base, because they're established as being on that ship. So.
You know, Anthony Daniels has got to cash them checks, man.
Right, and I don't have a problem with seeing them. And the other, but the one thing is when they had the dude, you know, watch your step, and the walrus face guy or whatever he is.
Yeah, that was dumb.
How did they get to Tatooine? They're not.
Matter.
That's not. I know, but why put them in that? I mean, they just put them in a fan service, but that one made no sense because these are just two schmucks. I don't picture them jaunting around the galaxy all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, I do. I do. I agree. And the universe is big, you guys. Like, the odds of them running into them, you know, seems unlikely.
Allie goes, I never realized the Death Star could go light speed. And I'm like, I guess I never pictured it, but it would have to go light speed.
Yeah.
If it's going to get anywhere,
right.
It'd be blowing up the same four planets.
yeah, man. I like that. I appreciate that these movies are coming out. I like the dark tone. I enjoy kind of getting to be in this universe in a different way. I get all the problems with it, but for me, you know, there's a pass-fail bar, and it passed. It's good.
It passed, right. It did pass. So, I mean, you know, and it's weird how now it's almost like a little send-off to Carrie Fisher, because she's the last person you see in the whole movie.
God, that's a bummer.
And she sort of kind of says the title of the first, you know what I mean? She's like, oh,
I do. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
She says that, so...
How do you feel about, I want to wrap this up, but how do you feel about Red Letter Media just destroying it? Have you seen that yet?
I watched it last night because, you know, I love the Red Letter Media. I mean, they have some good points. I don't agree with them on everything. I do agree with them. I think the characters were just not memorable. I mean, if you could have had this movie with characters like Rey and Kylo Ren and Poe Dameron and those guys, like that, those appealing of characters in this movie, I think it would have been a lot better movie.
I agree. And it's not
like what if
bad.
No, but think, what if the rebel guy, the guy's whose name I can't remember, who you said was in the terminal, that guy. Okay.
I can't remember.
What if he had been? I mean, you think of him as like a Poe Dameron kind of guy. Like,
yeah.
I mean, imagine Oscar Isaac's playing him, or be written like him. Then you'd feel something when he died. And this is like, well, he died and.
He does have one little moment, Will, where he says, you know, you can't pick and choose. His name's Diego Luna, and it's Cassian. His name's Cassian Andor. Guy was way off. Okay, he says you can't pick and choose when you want to rebel, when you want to fight. I've been living this life since I was six. That was a moment for me. I kind of was like, I feel you, man. But it doesn't make him any. I mean, that's why he's so dour and miserable. You know, Poe Dameron's like a funny rebel. This guy is not. Cassian Andor is not happy.
And then the two Asian guys, Donnie Yen, that's the actor. I'm looking this up. And Wen Zhang. The reason I know Donnie Yen is because he went in like a billion Hong Kong movies I watched when I was in my early 20s. He's like a martial arts master. The blind guy.
Okay. Yeah. No, I know. I figured. I just it's funny.
I thought, and I was a little disappointed. I thought when he's going to, and this is. These movies, they come down like, I have to flip a switch, you know, like flip the switch. But when he was going to do that, I thought what was going to happen is he would get shot down. He would be laying like 10 feet away. He would reach up and do it with the Force. Like he had sort of been like a Jedi inside the whole time. He was finally going to, you know, get that moment.
That's a good point.
If they were kind of like Jedis who didn't even know, you know, they were like the way Jedis were before they, you know, when they were all. You know, he so believed in the Force, he didn't realize it, but inside he was a Jedi kind of a thing.
Right.
I thought that was
kind of
cool.
They're like guardians of the Jedi Temple or whatever.
Right.
All right, we've probably talked this up. I mean, I would definitely say go see it, everybody. I mean, it's worth your money.
Yeah, go see it. It's fun. I mean, you know.
Oh, he says it less happy, but it's good.
What?
It's good. Well, you said it with a kind of a, go see it, but it's great.
No,
it's good.
I liked it better than the other one. I will say this. At least it isn't A New Hope done. At least they don't blow up a Death Star. They blow up a Death Star. Oh, by the way, did you like how we found out why the call sign Red 5 was available for Luke use?
Yes, I did.
Of course it is, though.
You know what movie this is better than?
What?
Die Hard 2.
Billy, you are not wrong, my friend. Die Hard 2, yeah. Back when we thought we'd have this episode out before Christmas, we decided we would follow last year's trend and watch Die Hard 2.
And you know, next year we're going to watch Die Hard 3, which I hear is good. I wish you would have, at the moment, said, you know, this one's not good.
Die Hard 3 is good. It's not nearly as good as Die Hard 1. It's way better than Die Hard 2. However, it takes place in the hot summer. It doesn't take place in Christmas.
You broke up a little bit there, but I believe you. Well, yeah. Tell us about this week's movie, Die Hard 2. Why?
Die Hard 2. Okay. It was released in 1990.
On the 4th of July.
On the 4th of July, yes. I had this written down. I don't have it now, but I looked up Die Hard 1, Die Hard 2, you know, both set at Christmas. And so I looked up, like, Miracle on 34th Street, It's a Wonderful Life, The Apartment. All these movies are set during the holidays. And I think maybe only The Apartment was released anywhere near Christmas. Like, It's a Wonderful Life came out in the spring, and Miracle on 34th Street came out in the summer. So I don't know what these studios are thinking. But anyway.
This is why you need marketing departments. This is why our jobs exist.
This is why. So thank God our jobs exist for something. Okay. Die Hard 2 takes place 2 years after the original Die Hard. So on Christmas Eve, it takes place around Washington Dulles Airport, I believe.
Yep.
John McClane is there. He's waiting for his wife, Holly McClane. She's taking back her married name now. She's on a plane getting ready to land. Naturally, terrorists seize the airport remotely with some 1990-type tech. And they want this, they're bringing in a General Ramon Esperanza, a drug lord and dictator of the fictional country of Valverde. And so they want this they want to get him and, you know, take him out of federal custody. And so they seize the airport. Of course, nobody believes it until it's too late. So John McClane feels that he has to save the day, and just as in the first one, he kind of runs afoul of the law and airport security and does what he can to stop the terrorists and get his wife's plane on the ground before it crashes, because all these planes are flying. They won't let any planes land because they shut off their runway lights and seize the control towers. And so the planes are going to crash unless John McClane saves the day.
Again, what's his line? He says, "Why does this keep happening to me?"
He says, "How can the same thing happen to the same guy twice?" Like, well, there you go. Because the first movie was a big fat hit, of course. And this one cost $70 million, made $240 million. So also a giant hit.
4X. Oh, my God, I hated it. Let me be fair. I hated the first 20 minutes especially. And then once you're kind of in the world of stupid, when you're just surrounded by stupid and you're living among stupid, then it kind of,
you're right.
You know, once you're in the filth, it's okay. Now we're all dirty. Let's just enjoy it.
Right, and it's like, you're right, it's stupid. It has, here's one cliche that I hate. It has the smart alecky old woman on the plane who's, like, got a taser that you know is going to be used later, and, you know, she's cracking wise. And then maybe this is because it was, you know, this was made in the late 80s, released in the early 90s, but it has that sort of 80s obnoxiousness about it. Like, Bruce Willis is much more of an ass than he was in the first one. You know, he's smoking everywhere and acting like Mr. Cool and making these wisecracks. And he's not as likable as he was the first time around.
You know, the first one, he had a lot of unlikable traits. Like, he takes his ring off and, like, hits on women and kind of...
Right.
But he doesn't stop after every action and look in the camera and wink like he does
in
this one.
Give that smirk, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, he's just sort of like it's almost like his character in Unbreakable, where he, like, hits on the woman at the beginning of the train, and then she says, "I'm married," or whatever, and gets up and leaves, and he puts his ring on and moves on. It's like, you kind of, it's almost sympathetic, you know, I'm like, ah.
Right, yeah.
In this movie, he's just a jackass.
He is just a jackass. Like when he's, like, you know, getting the facts from that woman at the airport counter, and of course she has to hit on him because... You know, why would she? But, you know, she does, and it's like... And then, I know. It's. I don't like anyone in this movie, except maybe... kind of like John Amos, the black guy who comes around, and it turns out he's one of the terrorists. But I kind of like him. He was funny. He seemed to have a good time.
I liked him, too. I also, the real hero of the movie for me is the journalist on the plane.
Of course! Wayne Atherton! He's the great 80s asshole.
he has about 10 seconds where he goes on too long about how brave and smart and awesome he is. But other than that, he does exactly what he's supposed to do. He's the best journalist on the planet.
Yes, he's great. He's working with 1990 technology, and he does like a live broadcast from a plane. Which is it's a huge story.
It's a massive story.
Right. And by the way, one thing in this movie, and I saw this movie in the theater way back when, and I remember in the theater being astonished by this moment, is the terrorists have taken over the air traffic control and everything, and the plane somehow remotely, like, planes controls. So there's a British plane that wants to land, and just to show they mean business, the terrorists, they make the plane think it's 100 feet in the air higher than it is, because it's very foggy, nobody can see. So when the plane is at, like, really only 50 feet off the ground, it thinks it's at 150 feet. So basically what's going to happen is when it thinks it's at 100 feet, it's at zero and it's going to crash. And they show the inside of the plane, and they could not have made this plane more British. Like, everyone is talking about being British, and everyone has an accent, and it's all British pound, you know, every cliche. And there's kids on the plane, too. And I remember sitting there thinking, well, they just showed a bunch of kids. And they crashed the plane and killed everyone on board. And I was like, I gotta admire that in a way.
And then the next scene is Bruce Willis running onto the runway, unchecked,
right.
He's fine, and picks up like a burning teddy bear or something.
Oh,
I was like, Jesus.
So
I was like, okay, you're like, we got it, man.
The reason I brought that up is later, you know, they're talking about news coverage of this and they want to keep it quiet or something. I'm like, a plane full of people just crashed. That's global news whenever it happens.
Right.
You know, that would be dominating the news cycle. And instead, it's like nobody in the airport seems to be paying much attention to it.
There's no reporters except the one obnoxious woman in the airline.
Yeah, one obnoxious woman reporter. Hey, John, how about it?
And, Holden, or whatever the guy's name is, from Shawshank Redemption, the bad guy in this movie. What's his name?
The bad guy. William Sadler's his name. In the movie, Colonel Stewart, Colonel William Stewart. Who read the anecdote about? Because when you first see him, he's doing nude yoga.
Why?
Like nude stretches? I don't know, but apparently, like, he showed up. Because if you read interviews with this guy, he's like a really funny, laid-back guy, William Sadler. And he said that the director was like, well, yeah, you're going to be doing nude yoga in your first scene in the movie. And he says, like, can we push the filming of that to the end so I can hit the gym for a while before I have to?
That's nice. I mean, that's logical.
Yeah.
It's Haywood from Shawshank.
Yeah. He's good. And then you get a little bit of original Belle Johnson, you know, Al from the first movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You get him. And you get Sipowicz. You get Dennis Franz from NYPD Blue. And you know, he's the obnoxious head of security who turns out to kind of be the ally.
Holy shit, I hate that guy.
That's Sipowicz, yeah.
I hate
him. He's a good actor, though. He's the best actor in the movie, probably.
Let me introduce you to my brother. It's like, oh,
I know that. That was my point. And then you have, what's his name? Fred Thompson, who ran for president, not this time, but last time, remember?
Yeah, I do. Oh, yeah.
He's the guy. He's also in Hunt for Red October, and he's in a bunch. He's kind of like the guy. He's, like, tough, but a good guy. You know, he's like the good guy.
Okay. He was good in this
movie
because
he's a good actor. He should never run for office, but he's a fun actor to watch.
He was brave. He had like a real sense of he's in charge and everybody shut up.
He's good. And you know, the guy who played the general is an Italian actor named Franco Nero, who was the original Django in all the old Django movies. He has a little tiny Django in
there. No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, it's a good cast.
Except maybe for Bruce Willis.
Do they all repeat in every one of these movies? You know, do we just see the same seven guys in the next movie?
In the third one, I think Bruce Willis is the only one in it, because Reginald Bell Johnson's not in it. His wife is mentioned, but she's not in it at all. I think he's the only one in the next one. But Sam Jackson is like the sidekick role in that one.
Right. Sam Jackson's good.
He's good.
I think he's got a little bit of an up and down reputation. Like, he's in Snakes in a Plane, and then he's also in, you know, whatever.
He has a reputation of he'll do like any movie if there's money on the table. But you know, he didn't get really going in acting, you know, as far as a star until he was in his 40s. So I'm sure you figure, like, hey, I'll take chances when I can get them. And he does great work. He was great in Hateful Eight and Django. You know,
he
does good work. And then he's fine as, like, Nick Fury. You know, he's fun.
Yeah. He's looking old, though. There was a few of those movies where he was starting to look a little... I realized he's, like, 71 or something.
Yeah, he's not... Yeah, because we just knew him when he was... When everyone sort of became aware of him, he was already, you know, middle-aged.
I got to tell you, I looked up William Sadler 2016 on Google Images, and he looks fine for being, like, 65 or whatever the hell he is. He looks fine.
Uh-huh.
But it's very depressing to realize, oh, yeah, we all get old.
We do, Billy. We do.
You look the same. Your photos look the same. You haven't aged in 15 years.
That doesn't mean I'm not going to die.
In fact, you've lost weight. You're probably in better shape now.
That doesn't mean, hey, it's all breaking down. That doesn't mean
your goddamn hairline. I hate it.
My hairline. I got a haircut this weekend. I'm sure all the listeners want to know that.
you have the hairline of the main character from Up. It's just this square line across the middle of your forehead.
You
I hate it.
You know whose hairline I don't have? Bruce Willis.
Neither does he.
So yeah, this movie, I think we can, I mean, the first movie is so tight. It like sets it up. There's a building, there's terrorists,
go.
Go up and down in a skyscraper, boom. And
it
works perfectly.
It's like a good D&D map.
Exactly. And this one is like, well, they got to go up by the church to shut this transmitter down, but no, they got to go do this, but then they got to go do this, but this, and then these new characters are coming in here, and yeah, I did like how they had the blue and the red on their guns so they could tell what was blank and what was not.
You know what I really liked about that was that they showed that maybe once or twice before they reveal what's happening. I mean, they don't just
do
it the one time for effect. They do it early in the movie, too.
They did. That was a nice setup.
Yeah, that's well done.
However, I think we can agree the scene where Bruce Willis takes a machine gun full of blanks and fires it at Dennis Franz in the middle of the control tower, while other cops slowly draw their guns on him. They would have taken him down instantly.
Yeah, the minute he pulls that trigger, or the minute he aims that gun, he's dead.
Right, the minute he pulls out a machine gun, they're going to take him down.
I don't know anything about guns. I sit at a computer for a living, everybody, but I was under the impression that if you fire a blank, it's still, like, there's still collateral damage, right? Like, oh, maybe I'm just thinking of, like, rubber bullets hurt.
No, they can't hurt you. By the way, I got a Christmas gift called A Writer's Guide to Weapons that covers all that, so I'll let you know.
Right. You know, maybe I'm running out of steam here on this movie, but one other point I wanted to bring up that's worth noting. Willis had one or two or three ad-libbed lines in the first movie that were such big hits with the audience that in this one, they just said, do whatever you want. Take whatever
one
liner.
Clearly a mistake.
Clearly a mistake. And what they ended up doing was, I don't know if they were just so in love with the idea, but every time Bruce Willis's back is turned and you can't see his face, they punch in a line.
Oh, did they do ADR?
Oh my God, it's bad. Especially bad. It's very, very noticeable when, at the very beginning of the movie, he runs into the two guys in the baggage claim or the baggage terminal, whatever that is.
Right.
Like, sorting.
Oh yeah.
Area. He turns his back three or four times, and every time he does it, they punch in a line. It doesn't sound like it even is in the same room.
That's weak.
Like, it's awful. It's like, kick that, dick, you know, or like, just stuff like that. It's awful.
That sounds stupid. I think we agreed that the baggage claim fight in Toy Story 2 is more believable and exciting than the baggage claim fight in this movie.
I can't even believe they survived it. It was so good.
One more observation, and I'll go out on something I actually liked in this movie. This movie is sort of a cartoon. I mean, it's not believable. The characters aren't subtle at all. You know, it's very broad. It's kind of stupid. However, I do like it when they sort of embrace the fact that it's a cartoon. And at the end of the movie, when a plane with all the bad guys on it and the general is getting away and that's going on. Meanwhile, the plane that his wife is on has to land. It's running out of fuel, but there are no lights on the runway. Bruce Willis, he's fighting on the wing. He manages to pop open the fuel tank. The fuel's coming out, and he lights it with his Zippo lighter and both blows up the plane and takes this, like, flaming path. And I liked that because it felt like something Bugs Bunny. You know, I've seen in a million old Warner Brothers cartoons, there's, like, a trail of fuel, and they light it, and it blows something up. And I'm like, that's funny. That works. That I like. I don't believe, then like 10 planes land right on top, you know, know, one right after the other at the end. And you can't do that. I mean, I've been on a plane. You have to wait until they land and clear the runway. Can't you?
It's not a... I mean, maybe there are... That's funny. I had... You have more of a hard time with the believability of the logistics of running an airport.
I do.
Flaming fuel that... Okay.
That I liked, because it was so damn goofy. And I still remember that years later. I was actually, when I rewatched just recently, I was looking forward to that moment. I wanted to see that.
I hated this goddamn movie. I thought this movie was just awful. This is maybe, we had a mini discussion about this a few weeks ago. This might be the dumbest movie we've reviewed for the podcast.
Right. The other one I was thinking going through was maybe Death Wish, but even that has a kind of simplicity to its stupidity. It's not as obviously stupid, you know what I mean?
It doesn't try to be funny. It's not stupid mixed with humor. It's just stupid.
Right. It just knows. It just is what it is. It doesn't try to be something cute or clever or something.
It's funny. I remember I was the one guy in the room that episode. I kind of liked it. Like, I was like, well, I mean, it fits itself. It's like its own, it's a weird outfit to wear, but it all goes together.
Right, it does. And it had Jeff Goldblum, friend of the show.
Yeah. This movie is not, it does not all go together. It's more. It's clearly like somebody just kept saying, well, add more, pump it up, add more guns,
right.
Add more, you know, more sets, more people, more. I mean, there's like 12 named cast members in this movie. It's crazy.
Yeah, and that was the sort of 80s and 90s action. More. I mean, this is the kind of thing that led to, Armageddon,
Face-off.
And led to
Face-Off, yeah.
And led to The Rock, and then Rock. That led to Transformers, and, you know, that kind of thing.
You know,
I mean, if you take
it.
Con Air is a perfect example. Yeah, think how many cast members are in that.
It was the second movie I ever let my son watch. He was 6 months old.
Somebody is going to take that boy away from you, my friend.
It was like New Year's or New Year's Eve.
Con Air.
My wife is out with her family, and he was like 6 months old or 8 months old or whatever. And I was like, I want to watch Con Air while I wrap presents or whatever. And so he hung out with me and... Any other final thoughts on Die Hard 2? I guess next year we'll have to do 3 and we'll feel better about it.
I think I don't want to blow out of proportion how good Die Hard 3 is. Not as good as the first one. However, I think it's a big improvement over 2. There's some good little twists and turns, although it's arguably even a little more sort of mean-spirited than Die Hard 2. And then we don't have to watch 4 and 5 in that.
We were going to record this episode 2 weeks ago now, but... We got hit with about 2 feet of snow in a few days. And I remember you standing in my driveway as I shoveled and you were trying to leave my house. And you're trying to tell me about the puzzles that Sam Jackson, you know, plays or whatever, his riddles or whatever he does in that movie. I've never seen it. I don't know. But you were trying to explain it to me and we both kind of looked around and went, you know what? Fuck it. There's 2 feet of snow on the ground. It's cold.
Exactly. Let's give it a break.
You want to play some trivia?
Let's do some trivia, Billy.
There's a lot of things you don't know anything about, Daddy. Things you wouldn't understand. Things you couldn't understand. Things you shouldn't understand.
I don't understand.
And we're back, everybody. You want to play some trivia, Will?
Yes, I do.
Unfortunately, I don't know how to play. Can you please explain the rules to me?
Oh, here's how it works. You pick a movie, I pick a movie. And then during the week between podcasts, each of us comes up with questions for the other's movie. And then we ask questions. And then we pick the next movie to focus on based on whoever wins.
I like how you generously said a week between podcasts and not 3 weeks.
That's right. It's the holidays, To all our loyal listeners, God bless you for listening. But really, how much are you paying for this podcast?
You pick.
Sometimes we're going to be a little late. I did, and you picked, in sort of an accidental Hitchcock theme, Rear Window.
No, it wasn't accidental. I didn't have a particular movie I wanted to do, and I thought North by Northwest sounded interesting, so I just piggybacked off you.
Oh, excellent.
Can I ask you the first question?
You certainly may.
All right, man. So there's a character. His name is Roger Thornhill, played by Cary Grant.
Right.
He's our hero, right?
Right.
What is his secretary's first name?
I don't know. I can picture scenes of them walking places, her like with her little steno pad taking notes. I cannot remember her. I want to say like Effie? I don't know.
It's Maggie.
Maggie.
Yeah.
Sorry. I didn't know that.
I tried to stick to the plot for all these, man.
No, that's fine. Okay. Let's see. Okay, Rear Window, 1954. Hitchcock, this is question one. Co-stars Jimmy Stewart and the lovely Grace Kelly. This movie was made in 1954 when Grace Kelly was 25 years old. Her last movie was made in 1956, High Society. She never made any more movies. Why is that?
I have no idea, man.
Oh, really?
That's not a plot.
I know this isn't part of the plot, but I thought you would know this because she's arguably more famous for this than she was for acting.
I have to tell you, I had to look up Grace Kelly because I know the name. I was like, is she one of the dancing people? Like, you know,
she was, what's her name? She was Lisa. She was his girlfriend.
I know that in the context of this movie. My point is, I don't know anything about Grace Kelly.
About it. Okay, well, I'll tell you. Because after 1956, she married the Prince of Monaco and literally became a princess. She was Princess Grace. There you go. She really became a princess and broke Hitchcock's heart.
I heard. I was doing the research. Apparently, she broke everybody's heart.
She got around.
I heard that with her leading man, especially, and she had all these quotes about how masculine. Who's the lead guy? I'm sorry.
In this movie, Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah, Stewart. Who hated being called Jimmy?
Right, James. He went James or Jim.
He wanted to be Jim.
Jim? Oh, I've never heard that. I believe it, but I've never heard it.
All right, question two.
Okay.
Zero to zero. Where does Roger Thornhill meet his friends for drinks right before he's kidnapped?
Is it at the... It's at the Plaza, right?
It is. I will give you that. It's the Oak Bar at the Plaza.
The Oak Bar in the Plaza, though, right?
Yeah, yep. They specifically picked that because... Cary Grant stayed at that hotel so often that he was super comfortable in that bar. That was like his bar.
Nice, nice. It's a pretty famous hotel. It's, you know.
Yeah. All right.
One to zero. I hate to say it, but I think a lot of mine are not.
Oh, it's okay. I don't mind. Listen, I got to tell you, I'm going to go 0-5 here. If I get one or two, I'll be delighted.
Okay. What is the connection with this movie to Alvin and the Chipmunks?
Oh boy, I have no idea. They both use fake sunlight?
No.
That's true, by the way.
You know, all the different people he's watching.
Yeah, there's like
and
30.
One of them is the songwriter with the piano.
Yeah.
That is Ross Bagdasarian, who invented David of Alvin and the Chipmunks. He's the guy who created Alvin and the Chipmunks.
I had no idea. That's so funny. Yeah. I've been listening to Cinderella. We've been putting my kid to bed.
Cinderella.
Yeah, and they have the sped up voices for the mice.
Yes.
And I can't. I feel frustrated with Alvin and the Chipmunks for ripping that off.
Was it after that?
But Cinderella was like the 50s, right? Like 51 or something.
Yeah. Is it that old?
Yeah. It's clearly old. It's super old.
Because Alvin and the Chipmunks is from the 50s too. But
Cinderella.
Cinderella Man? No, 1950, right. Yeah, this that must predate Alvin and Chipmunks.
Oh, whatever. Sorry, we...
Okay.
Question three for North by Northwest. In the film, the Townsend Estate is located in what Long Island town?
I should have known you were going to ask it. I just watched it, too. I can't remember.
It's Glen Cove.
Glencoe, that's right. The Townsend Estate. There's like a big sign, Townsend, on the lawn.
I gotta be honest, I haven't seen this movie, so I don't know if I'm asking unfair questions.
No, that's fine. They mentioned it several times. Like, and he goes to the sheriff's department, too, so no, that's a perfectly fair question.
All right, man. One to zero. It's an ass whooping.
Zero. Let's see. I'm trying to find one that's relatively fair. Okay.
No, it's okay, man.
Okay. The villain of the movie is Raymond Burr, okay, the guy who's the guy who they suspect of murdering his wife.
Okay.
This is a completely unfair question, but it's interesting, though.
Okay.
Normally, Raymond Burr had dark hair, but in this movie, he has white, almost kind of curly hair on top. Why did
he
have that hair? Right. Why did Hitchcock make him look like that?
Rear Window wasn't black and white.
No, it's color.
Yeah, so I don't, in the contrast, I assume, but I don't know.
No, it's because Hitchcock... Hitchcock had worked with the producer David O. Selznick and hated him. Hated him. David O. Selznick is the guy who essentially brought Gone with the Wind to the screen, and he worked with Hitchcock.
Yeah.
He was a real bastard. So Hitchcock deliberately made the murderer look like David O. Selznick in this movie. He gave him glasses, he gave him that hair, so he would look like David O. Selznick.
That's really funny. He does kind of look like him. Yeah, I just Googled it. 0 for 3. Question 4, Will. Part of the plot behind this movie is to kill Roger Thornhill.
Right.
What drink did they make him drink as part of that plot?
Was it bourbon?
It was
like
bourbon.
A whole bottle
right.
of bourbon, right.
It was bourbon. Two. I feel like you should get an applause. These are not easy questions.
I watched it not too long ago. This is a fun movie, by the way. So it's almost like a comedy, really. It's like his suspense comedy. It's a lot of fun.
2-0. I have to get this right or I'm done.
Okay. There was a TV movie remake of this in 1998. Okay. A famous actor, modern actor, I mean, modern for the 90s, 80s,
some of the
70s, played the Jimmy Stewart role. Do you know who it was? And it's weirdly appropriate if you know. Specifically, something that happened to this actor years before this.
It's the dead guy. It's the guy who played Superman.
Yes, it is. I will give it to you.
It's Reeve. Something Reeve.
It's Christopher Reeve. Yeah, you get that. You get that. Yeah, because he was in a wheelchair. He was paralyzed,
Didn't he die of, like, bed sores or something? Like,
he died, I can't remember specifically, but he was in a horse-riding accident and paralyzed.
Right after Superman, right?
Right. Well, no, it was years after. It was,
I thought it was in the 70s.
No. It was definitely in the 90s, in fact, I'm sure.
You know, I have this weird mix-up between him and Clint Eastwood, and I don't know why. Like, I think of them as both, like, conservative, like, propagandists, you know, like Second Amendment.
I
want to
say, and I can't be sure, that Christopher Reeve was once the guest at the benefit for our old employer, Rosecrans.
Really?
Yeah, this would be before his accident. For some reason, I want to say that somebody else couldn't make it, and Christopher Reeve said, I'll do it, and he stepped in, like, at the last minute. Because he was apparently a stand-up guy. No. Oh, God, I can't believe that's he was a good guy.
What a monster you are.
I can't believe I said that. I honestly didn't mean to.
Well, that's the cool. I'll send that out on Twitter. Christopher Reeve, stand-up guy. I got two final questions for you. I'm going to pick one that I think is harder.
Okay.
Whose Mercedes did the phony Mrs. Townsend say he borrowed after the phony party?
Okay.
Whose Mercedes was it?
I can't remember. I know what you're talking about, but I honestly can't remember.
It's Laura Babson. You find out her last name because of the police report, they say.
Oh, okay. Because he, like, stole it when he was drunk and it's like...
All right, that's a little bit.
One
of here's a more rare question. That's not fair. This is the only other one I got for you. Roger is put behind the wheel to drunk drive. And the idea is that he will die. What thing makes him stop the car?
Is it a police car? Pulls him over,
it's a bike. A man on a bike.
Man on a bike, okay. He doesn't hit him. By the way, Hitchcock is known for his terrible rear projection that he does in his movies.
Sure.
You know, like, and this has some of the worst. When those driving scenes, so phony looking. Cary Grant, like, being drunk driving in the background, like, all over the place.
It's like the Star Trek ships when they, like, tilt the camera to make everybody look like they fell.
Pretty much, yes. That's pretty much exactly what.
All right, man. You only have two, so I can tie it here.
You can tie it here. Okay. Let's see. I'm trying to find the one. Okay. In the movie, the set, it's like one of the biggest sets that was ever made up to that point. Because all those apartments were real, you know, and they were distance away. How did Hitchcock communicate with the actors in those apartments?
I regret that I know this. I know a lot about this. I took a lot of notes on this. So there are like 30 or 31 actual apartments. 8 of them were fully furnished. In fact, one of the characters, I forget her name now, but she only got paid like $350 to be in this movie, lived in her apartment during the day, during the downtime, because they were done. They had running water. All of them had running water, running electricity. to a point where Hitchcock decided to stay in one of them, and that was Jeff's apartment, and he directed everything by walkie-talkie through earpieces.
That's right. Very good, very good. Because
he lived in that.
Yeah, like, and he wanted everything seen from Jeff's apartment.
Yeah.
That's how the whole movie is. You see everything from Jeff's apartment.
I got it. I'm on board with it. I like Hitchcock. He seems crazy, but I like him.
Well, we should do North by Northwest and Rear Window sometime. We should do them both. We haven't done either one, and they're both great movies.
It is fitting that this one ends in a tie, because we're going to do just one more episode. Lucky for us, this one doesn't determine what we're going to watch next week. We're going to do one more episode before we take a little bit of an extended break between season two, wrapping up our season two, and moving into season three, right?
Right, exactly. So what we'll do, kind of a wrap-up, a kind of, looking back and, talking movies, and it'll be fun.
So it's funny. We're recording this one on the 27th of December. We're going to release it tonight. I'm going to edit this tonight, and we'll get this out so we can keep our Monday release date schedule. We'll have our wrap-up episode next week. What is that, January 2nd or something? What day is that? It's the 2nd. Yeah, January 2nd will be our final episode of the year, and that will be our 2016 wrap-up. I want to talk. We haven't really done a lot of this is the first episode in a while where we've actually watched movies ahead of time and talked about them. We've been kind of saving for a few weeks. And I got all sorts of them. I'd love to talk to you about Batman, Superman, and many others. I saw Drive, which ruled.
Drive is a good movie, isn't it?
We got a lot of ground to cover. So we'll kind of, I'd also like to take some time in that episode next week to look back at some of the movies that I had strong opinions on one way or the other, and sort of maybe update my opinion on those.
Okay. And also a movie we saw together, The Nice Guys, we can talk a bit about.
God, which I...
Very good movie.
I sent you a photo of it. It's so funny. It's not a kid's movie. The opening shot is just boobs. You know, it's just like just nudity in a 12-year-old looking at porn. And I saw it on the shelf at Target right next to The Hunger Games and the Minions
else
movie.
Yeah, the Minions.
And I was like, wow, this is good product placement for...
It's better than any of those movies, I'm sure.
All right, man. We got one more episode to go. It's been a pleasure. We'll try to get together in person, but we'll see how this turns out. Maybe we'll have to do it by phone again. It really has dropped a foot of snow all over the good land here.
The good land.
Rocker, baby. All right.
Okay.
On behalf of Will Pfeiffer, my name is Billy Copeland. We'll miss you all most of all.